This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
12:03, Thursday afternoon, June 13th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. New numbers on producer prices and jobless claims out today. We'll break them down in our next segment. But right now, early planning can help keep down the costs of school in the fall. We're joined by Jennifer Waters, Chicago-based business reporter. Jennifer, thank you for joining us today. And one thing I have really noticed as a dad now, compared to being a student over 30 years ago, is that way back when in grade school, summer vacation just seemed like this endless time of fun. And now as an adult, you say, boy, it goes by really fast.
Yeah, I'll say that. Isn't that the truth? It goes by so much faster than it ever did. Every year does, for that matter. But, you know, with the back to school shopping, and this is a prime example of how fast the summer's going to go. Now is the time to start planning for back to school shopping. Make a budget, make a list, price compare, think about what you need to do, and then watch for sales. And you're going to see a lot of sales out there already. We've got Walmart Plus membership sale days like Amazon Prime. Those start next Monday, and they're till the 23rd of June. So, you know, get your list together now and take a look at what they've got. And then Amazon Prime Days will be in July. We don't know exactly when yet, but they're usually about mid-July. And, of course, there's a lot of back-to-school sales going on then. And then remember, too, that stores like Target, Kohl's, Best Buy, and even Walmart will follow Amazon's Prime Day sale, because of those, of course, are just for members. So they'll have their own sales going on at the same time. And Apple, too, has its back-to-school sale days. Those are primarily aimed at college students, but those will be coming soon. And just this week, they discounted the new 2024 MacBook Air. But the back-to-school sales typically include discounts plus gift cards in the $150 to $200 range.
We're talking back-to-school.
It's time to start thinking about that. Go ahead, Rob.
Say, we're talking back-to-school shopping with Chicago-based business reporter Jennifer Waters. It's crazy we're having this discussion right now, especially since for my three girls, summer vacation began last Friday, and we're already talking about going back. But there is an element of timing involved, because there are some staples you know you are going to need, but you probably get supply lists from next year's teacher later on in the summer. And then there are other annual events like sales tax holidays that usually take place in the month of August. So you can does the early bird necessarily get the worm under those circumstances?
I think so. I mean, you know, you're a professional back to school shopper now, or your wife, and you are. But I mean, I think if you look at that, you know what some of the things are you're going to need. You're going to need some new shoes, gym shoes, whatever. You're going to maybe need a new backpack. Check that out. You're going to need paper and pens and all of that kind of stuff, too. So you put those lists together of things you know you're going to need every year, and then shop the sales as they pop up. The thing about clothing, too, for kids, I mean, now is a good time to start thinking about that. But, you know, what we've learned from many students is that they don't really want to start buying new clothes until they know what everyone else is wearing. So they want to go to school with something they thought was cool in, you know, July, but then, you know, it's September and it's totally out of style.
No, this is now bringing back memories of doing back to school clothes shopping at Kids R Us. Remember that? Kids R Us.
Oh,
and it was next to the Toys R Us at the Orland Square Shopping Center. So you just look out the window and the cool store was just right there. And here you are trying on Bugle Boy jeans. I don't know if maybe your experience was the same. Jennifer Waters.
No, I wore uniforms.
You know, uniforms, they make back-to-school shopping, especially for clothes, that much easier. Jennifer Waters, Chicago-based business reporter, thank you for joining us today. Coming up, a look at the latest snapshot of the economy.
This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
The latest reports on producer prices and applications for unemployment assistance are out today. Let's see what they signal with Bob Bruska, chief economist, Fact and Opinion Economics in New York. Bob, thank you for joining us today. We had the consumer price index yesterday. Now we have the producer price index out today, which talks about the prices businesses are paying for wholesale goods and also a proxy for future inflation, if that's what shows up in the numbers. And like yesterday's CPI, there's a lot to like in the PPI report.
Yeah. Actually, there's a lot that's not in the PPI that we like. It's minus 0.2% in the headline. A core that was flat, that's excluding food and energy. So month-to-month, those are good numbers. Looking at year-over-year headline, up 2.2%. And a core up about 2.3%. So that's pretty disciplined. But the problem with the PPI, just like the CPI, is that the trends are still not good. These two reports have not been good enough to boil out the uptrends that had been developing. So they blunt what was in progress, but they haven't, reversed things. So I think that's still an important point here.
Yeah, I was going to say, as I put on my chairman of the Federal Reserve hat, Bob, this is a one-off for now, and one good report does not make a trend. So what are we what do you want to see in future reports that indicate that this trend of disinflation, or at very least leveling off, is sustainable?
Yeah, well, we just need to see more of the same. One of the things that I do is I calculate the number of very high increases that we get in these reports over the last 12 months, and I make a plot of those over time. And what the problem is that while we can get a good report here and there, statistically, the number of high reports that we get across the months is just too high to expect that any good monthly number is going to continue to settle down. You need to have a menu of them. We need to see the various commodity categories having smaller increases. We need to see the monthly numbers come in more consistently with low numbers, maybe some negative numbers, not so many high numbers. And so we're looking for that collection of numbers to get better. And we need for it to get better, and we need for it to become better in a stable fashion. And that's what isn't happening.
And then very quickly, it is Thursday. That means we talk about the initial claims for unemployment insurance. And it jumped to 242,000. That's the highest level since August of 2023. But even with an increase, we're still talking about historic low numbers for first-time unemployment claims.
Excuse me. Well, right. And on top of that, I tend to look at that series by looking at what the current number is compared to what it did over the last 10 weeks. So I take it as a ratio of the base 10 weeks ago. And I compare it to what happened last year and the year before. And last year, of course, around this time, we were having an even bigger ramp up. And so there may be some kind of a seasonal problem that the seasonal adjustment factors haven't been adjusted to take, because we're seeing a repeat of what happened last year. And the increase that we had in claims last year was even larger than this year. So this may not be the signal that it seems to be to some people. 240 is a big number compared to where we've been. It's a small number compared to history. The key thing is going to be whether it stays here or goes back down. And so right now, the comparison with last year suggests this might not be permanent.
Bob Bruska, Chief Economist, Fact and Opinion Economics in New York. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, planning for your baby's future by getting them a credit card.
It's 60 Minutes of Financial Planning. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
One of the steps to put your infant on strong financial footing could involve a credit card. Let's learn more from Ted Rossman, Senior Industry Analyst at Bankrate.com, based in New York. Ted, thank you for joining us today. And we're not talking about a toddler rolling up to Dairy Queen and offering to buy ice cream cones for all of his friends on his Amex Gold card. We're actually talking about adding your infant as an authorized user on your credit card so they can start building credit even as they're learning to walk.
That's right. I love the authorized user approach. I think doing it for babies and toddlers is a bit early, although some people advocate for that. I'm a huge fan of doing this, though, in the teenage years, because it's a great way to build credit. Your kid can piggyback off your hopefully positive payment history. I'm a big fan of doing this around age 16 or 17. So your kid hasn't quite hit adulthood. They're probably still living at home, maybe starting to drive, but also being more independent. And it's a great way to build credit and also teach some responsibility, because paying with credit is different from cash.
And that's not the only thing that you could do when a child is born to set them up for the future. I know of some people who establish email accounts with their name in them, so they're not dealing with first name, last name, bunch of numbers by the time they actually begin their online existence. And then one thing that could pay off almost immediately is setting up a frequent flyer account for your infant, and you could use that within a matter of months if you're from a family that does a lot of traveling.
That is a smart thing to do. Yeah, I have a couple of young kids, and I did this with them from an early age. They can fly as lap children up until age two, but especially once you start buying them their own seats, yeah, it definitely pays off to get those frequent flyer miles because they can earn and redeem just like an adult could. So I know my family of four racks up more miles when all four of us are in the program. So yeah, as long as you're buying seats for everybody, that's a great way to stack up the miles, and you can sometimes combine them in your frequent flyer account, and it just makes it quicker to get a free trip.
And then very quickly, Ted, if you do sign up a child or maybe a toddler as an authorized user on your credit card so they can begin building credit, are there any additional steps you have to take before you complete that maneuver?
It's usually easy to do, but note that some issuers have minimum ages, like American Express and U.S. Bank say you have to be at least 13. At Discover, you have to be at least 15. At Wells Fargo, you have to be at least 18. Other major issuers don't have a minimum age, so I guess no harm in doing it earlier, but generally speaking, you'll get the same practical benefit if you wait a little bit. I think the teenage years are an ideal time to start.
Ted Rossman, Senior Industry Analyst, Bankrate.com in New York. Thank you for joining us today. Still ahead in Technology Thursday, making your phone last as long as possible.
This is Chicago's News Traffic and Weather Station, News Radio 105.9. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. The Supreme Court upholds the distribution of an abortion pill. The new information coming out about a shooting in Dixon, Illinois that injured some Ogle County Sheriff's deputies yesterday. Technology Thursday on the Noon Business Hour will tell you how you can expand your phone's pocket life, as it were, and we'll preview Chicago in the summertime. It's a big one with two major events in town. Business, the markets are mixed right now. The Dow is down 131 points. The NASDAQ up 32. The S&P 500 up 3. 85 degrees right now under mostly sunny skies. It's 12:31. Topping our news at the half hour. The Supreme Court has preserved access to the drug mifepristone. Justices ruled unanimously that abortion opponents lacked legal standing to sue over its approval by the FDA. The details from CBS News correspondent Jan Crawford.
This ruling today, 9-0, a unanimous Supreme Court saying these doctors should have never brought that in the first place. And that's important message to the lower courts. One more point why it's important, an important message to the lower courts to put the brakes on some of these kind of creative legal arguments to try to restrict abortion access or to change it in states that don't allow it.
The drug was used in almost 2/3 of abortions in the U.S. last year. Three deputies from the Ogle County Sheriff's Office are recovering from wounds suffered during an incident yesterday. A woman in Dixon had called police saying her adult son was expressing suicidal and homicidal thoughts. After more than an hour of failed attempts to communicate with the man, the police entered the residence. A deputy suffered a gunshot wound to the face. Another was hit in the upper arm, while another was struck in the body armor. The suspect was also wounded. It's 12:32 as the Noon Business Hour continues. Markets are mixed right now. We welcome in Art Hogan, Chief Market Strategist, B. Riley Financial in New York. Art, thank you for joining us today. And as far as the fight against inflation is concerned, we have two positive data points this month, but they're just merely two positive data points.
Yeah, I would tell you that's good news, though, and I think that the first quarter was a little disappointing in terms of the lack of traction we were making towards the battle against inflation. And lo and behold, in the second quarter, we seem to be getting better. So that sticky piece of the inflation picture seems to be easing up a bit. Both the CPI and the PPI came in better than expected. That's 2 months in a row for both. And I think that that's going to change the complexion of what monetary policy looks like, probably as early as September of this year. But I think that the other piece of good news here is that while the Fed yesterday might have changed their dot plots in the summary of economic projections to one rate cut this year versus three that they had back in March, investors didn't seem to be too perturbed by that. And I think that's good because I think investors have gotten to the place where they're willing to forego rate cuts for better economic data, which we clearly seem to be getting right now.
It seems like the United States is unique among economies around the world in that while other countries are their central banks are starting to cut interest rates after that run-up of inflation over the last couple of years, the U.S. has economic growth that is stronger than the rest of the world, and that's why they're holding steady for now, the Fed.
Right, and the, you know, when the Fed talks about cutting rates, are really trying to do that in a way of becoming less restrictive and normalizing rates. When I think the EU and the Bank of Canada cut rates, what they're really doing is saying, okay, we acknowledge where we are in our fight against inflation, but we need to stimulate. And I think that that's a different kind of a rate cut. So, you know, while we have divergent global monetary policy right now, I suspect that come this fall, we'll all be sort of in the same party here and all be heading lower on interest rates. It's just, to your point, it's taking the Federal Reserve a bit longer because of the strength of the economy, which in turn will likely drive better earnings and better revenue growth.
And then trying to evaluate the economy writ large, especially interest rate sensitive sectors of the economy. Well, one thing that is unique to the U.S. Around the world is the fact that the Americans, by the millions, refinance their mortgages when interest rates were non-existent. So part of that growth and part of that resilience, it looks like, was driven by a lot of homeowners in 2020 and 2021 who locked in 2% and 3% mortgages, and now that's a source of household wealth.
It certainly is, and that is unique to the United States. It's interesting. I was giving a speech in Canada not too long ago, and when we talked about interest rates, one of the questions that came up was, well, what are you going to do when those roll over? And I wasn't aware of the fact, and you know, now know that the U.S. is unique in having a 30-year fixed mortgage. You know, if you're in Canada or in the EU, you know, the longest you're going out is 3 or 4 or 5 years on a mortgage before you have to change that interest rate. So I think that that has been a source and one of the reasons why higher interest rates have been as stimulative as they've been restrictive, meaning, you know, folks my age, baby boomers, are actually finally making money on their cash and going out and spending a lot of it doing, you know, things like going to baseball games and Taylor Swift concerts. So, yeah, it's been quite the conundrum, and that's why the U.S. is in a uniquely different position than the Canadians or the folks in the Eurozone.
And then a couple of story stocks today. Broadcom up 13% after another chip maker. Life is good. If you can make microchips, this is your time, topping their fiscal second quarter expectations. And they're also in the stock split game. NVIDIA is not the only one. However, Dave & Buster's dropping 11% after their first quarter revenue missed estimates. Does this mean that more adults need to take up skee ball?
Such a great point. I was going to use that line myself. Yeah, it is amazing that the semiconductors up and down the supply chain have certainly done better this year. And Broadcom got their chance to be in the barrel today and throwing out the stock split, which obviously has worked for any of the companies that made those announcements so far this year. I think Dave & Buster's is just talking about the U.S. consumer and the fact that they're getting picky and they have choices, right? So I think Dave & Buster's is one of those, you know, fast casuals that's got a unique experience for you. But if that's not your cup of tea and you're watching your pennies, you may be going somewhere else like an Applebee's or McDonald's. I think it's as easy as that. We have as many winners in the restaurant business as we have losers. And I think that's because the U.S. consumer is starting to get to a place where they're being selective.
Art Hogan, Chief Market Strategist, B. Riley Financial in New York. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Technology Thursday, figuring out your phone's expiration date.
Money talks as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Technology Thursday. You may not be aware that your phone has an expiration date. Let's talk about that and ways to possibly extend it with Jennifer Jolly, Tech Life columnist for USA Today, founder, editor-in-chief of Techish.com based in San Francisco. Jennifer, thank you for joining us. joining us today. Now, there are some car owners who are very proud of the fact that they can drive their car into the ground. Not too long ago, I saw a picture on social media of somebody who was proudly driving his car into the junkyard after putting 200,000 plus miles on it. Can you actually use your cell phone into the ground?
There are those people who do, but you might be surprised to find out your gadgets, your smartphones, actually come with an expiration date, just like milk, just like bike helmets, just like a lot of other things in our lives. They are sold with a built-in expiration date. So if you think your iPhone starts acting really weird after about 5 years, that's because it does.
And that means a sign the expiration date may be on the horizon is that it doesn't hold a charge nearly as well as it once did, or maybe it's running very slowly, or just simply can't use new operating systems or new software.
Yeah, you just hit it all right exactly on the bullseye. The way to sort of find out what your manufacturer or your lifespan of your device is, your phone's device, is to know that that clock starts ticking from the manufacture date, not when you bought the phone. So you want to go in and you want to look at when that was built. And there's a few ways to find out. It's often on the package. If you're buying something new, buy the serial number, or you can go to endoflife.date. And there's dates there, links for your iPhone, your Samsung phone, your Google Pixel phones. Also for your watches, your tablets, things like that. And that's why, you know, you don't really want to get tech that's used, or you want to double check if it's used and it's past its end of life date. Well, then steer clear of it.
We're talking about cell phone and other gadget expiration dates with Jennifer Jolly, Tech Life columnist for USA Today. Now, in some cases, especially if you're in the Apple ecosystem, that expiration date is imposed on you. I can it was a couple of years ago when Apple switched out the charging cords. And if you had the big fat one from way back when, your phone or your tablet was obsolete overnight.
Yeah, also, some of the older devices don't run the newer operating systems. And that's really bad for, you know, hackers, or it's bad for you because hackers really love exploiting those unfixed bugs and security issues that come a lot with outdated tech. That we see that a lot on older flip phones, older Android phones, and older iPhones. So you'll get that bad battery life. They're more apt to be hacked. There are a few things that you can do to extend that end of life. You can keep your phone, your devices updated, you know, go to the settings, do all your software updates. You can replace the battery, usually for around $100 or less, use a case, and then look after your battery, that kind of good battery hygiene. Keep it between temperatures between 32 and 95 degrees. Keep it out of the sun, you know, out of the snow. Delete the junk. You know, you do quick cleanups on your devices. Delete all that junk that's in there. And just know, check out the column at usatoday.tech or usatoday.com/tech. And just know what that end of life date is. Again, if iPhone, 4 to 8 years. Mine seemed to act really weird about 5 years in.
And then very quickly, for most people, though, I mean, they get a new phone when when it's time to upgrade, when their cell phone plan administrator calls them or sends them an email and say, hey, you know, it's been 3 years, time to upgrade. But that's probably for the average person. I mean, how many people really do drive that phone into the ground?
Well, I feel like I know a lot of them. There's a lot of people who really want to save money. They don't love the idea of just kind of continually handing $1,000 over to Apple for the newest device, the newest device, the newest device. And a lot of other people, if you have a Samsung phone, you're looking at 3 to 6 years, a Google Pixel, 3 to 5 years, Huawei phones, 2 to 4 years. So you're looking at even less time from that end of life date. And the secondhand market is huge. It's booming. So there are a lot of people who do that.
Jennifer Jolly, Tech Life columnist for USA Today, based in San Francisco. Thank you for joining us today.
The only program dedicated to currency events. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Chicago is always a bustling city, but this summer will be an especially jam-packed one. Let's preview the coming months with Ariella Gibson, spokeswoman Chicago Loop Alliance. Ariella, thank you for joining us today. And I know there's been a lot of discussion, especially over the last couple of years, about the recovery of downtown Chicago, and especially the tourism space coming out of the depths of the COVID pandemic. But my personal moment where I said to myself, we are so back, might have been last summer walking west on Randolph to get to my commuter train. And for the first time since the COVID-19 pandemic, I was cursing mentally the slow walker in front of me. And I know that's to me, that's an annoyance, but to you, that's money in the bank.
Precisely. Thanks for having me, Rob. But that's the general sentiment, I think, of most people who are regularly in the loop these days. They're feeling the allure and the frustrations of being back and being back with millions of other people, which is a pleasure for us to have.
Now, we have one big event coming up just a matter of weeks, and that is the NASCAR race. And even though last year's race took place after a major flooding downpour, just looking on social media, even the most hardened cynic said afterward, boy, the city looked really cool in the NASCAR race. So I'm guessing you're hoping for a repeat, not of the rain, but of the positive reception start in early next month.
Right, yeah, and if rain put a damper on that and we still had over $100 million in economic impact, what would a sunny day be or a sunny weekend be? So I think we're all elated and excited about the potential impacts, be it people, money, investment, or just a positive narrative that beautifies the city in the way that we all think it is on a daily basis to the rest of the world.
And then last year, of course, we had the Renaissance Tour, Beyonce, the Eras Tour, Taylor Swift. In August at the United Center, we have Joseph R. Biden, the reelection tour taking place at the Democratic National Convention. And the city's once again going to be in an international spotlight. I mean, the whole world is going to be keeping an eye on what's happening here. And does the Chicago Loop Alliance feel that this could be an inflection point, that your 84% of 2019 tourism numbers, and that if the city looks great in both the NASCAR race and the DNC, that you could potentially get back to that 100% level?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think it's a little bit of both. It's definitely an inflection point for the world and the nation to see Chicago as this beacon of innovation, of diversity, of just like a great downtown. What it is, for sure, the facts can't dispute that. But also that it's not just because of the DNC that we're this bright, shiny, you know, picture like the bean reflecting off all these positive attributes, but that we as a city have intentionally made investments into our communities, be it the Loop or communities and neighborhoods on the far south and west sides, to make sure that our city is representative of what we want it to be for our residents, for our visitors, for our workers, now and in the future. And I think the DNC is a great example of that opportunity.
Ariella Gibson, spokeswoman, Chicago Loop Alliance, thank you for joining us today.